are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 13th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, reflecting upon President Obama's final State of the Union address, and we may also talk about the Democratic Brown and Black Forum in Iowa. The Uber blogger, the Salon.com columnist, Heather Digby Parton. Also on the program today, the Oregon militiamen get some very rude things in the mail, apparently. Debbie Wasserman Schultz facing what could be a very, very strong challenge to her in her primary. Meanwhile, the clown car, Ted Cruz dogged by his birthright, Jeb Bush told to heal by the Republican establishment, and Donald Trump rolls on. Things are not only tightening in Iowa, some polls showing Bernie Sanders moving into the lead in Iowa. Oh, and that war we had supposedly begun last night with Iran, where they had humiliated us. They released the 10 U.S. naval personnel who had entered into their territorial waters. The disappointment from right-wingers and conservatives that we actually successfully got these 10 servicemen back so quickly is palpable. It's almost hard to breathe. Their disappointment is so heavy in the air. And, well, as if you pulled out a jug of milk from the fridge, tasted it, thought it tasted bad, put it back in the fridge to see if it's going to taste better in another week. The Pentagon weighing as to whether or not it should train more Syrian fighters. So there you have it, folks.
It's starting to remind me of how you talk about Air America's management.
What's that?
The, like, ever-evolving train new Syrian fighters plan.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah, well, we got a new set of people coming in, although this is the sort of seems to be the same set of people. It's just a sort of a rolling scam on some level. I don't know. But that involved, this time around, it involves Turkey basically saying, you know, we may have made a mistake before. And in fact, there was a major terrorist bombing. Was it today?
It was Monday, I believe. It was by the Hagia Sophia, which is a really beautiful, actually, mosque and church in a major tourist destination, Istanbul. That was done by ISIS.
And, of course, this is it would appear that Turkey is regretting its decision to have allowed their border to be so porous in hopes that ISIS fighters would defeat Kurdish fighters. And now it's there's a little bit of, well, a little bit, it seems to be a lot of bit of blowback. And they are asking the U.S. to provide training or and or weapons for Sunni fighters in northern Syria as a way of maintaining the integrity of that border. So there you have it, folks. They just move the chess pieces around. Meanwhile, thousands upon thousands die. But the Iran situation resolved itself, and the desperation from the Republicans. Honestly, there was just a palpable dripping desperation. Joe Scarborough, I thought somebody had hacked his account on Twitter yesterday, talking about this situation with Iran as if there was, like, he was being held hostage and there was some type of major explosive weapon in his home. And he's just saying, well, you know, something's got to happen. Okay, it all got resolved. And, you know, the reality is that the reason why something like that gets resolved, I think there's a direct line that you can make to the recent negotiations on the nuke deal with Iran, because you have all these channels now open where there's actually people who say, like, oh yeah, no, I talked to the Secretary of the Interior in Iran. I spoke to him last week. I spoke to him on Friday. So I'll call him today. You have all these relationships that are there. So that's resolved. And, you know, many people have made the point that we had to apologize, I think, like, multiple times. And George Bush had to send, like, orange baskets, and it took, like, 3 or 4 weeks for the Chinese to return. I can't remember how many servicemen it was, but nobody made a big deal about that at all, as far as I can remember.
No, not only that, and wasn't that the crowd when they came into office that was sort of itching for a more competitive relationship with China?
Well, yes, but that all that stuff didn't happen. I mean, that stuff didn't really show its teeth till after September 11th, I think. I mean, those first 10 months of that Bush administration were just pathetic. Nevertheless, so that's the situation. We're going to get to Digby in a moment, but I should tell you folks, and I think most of you are aware, it is 2016. It's a new year. It's time for a fresh start. Let's make a resolution, folks. Here's a very simple one. And actually, this sort of combines two that I had this year. My first one was more facial hair. I was going to have a mustache in 2016. And then I did it, and I got it over with really early. That is the way to go with this stuff. Do like a one-day resolution so that literally you can finish it in the first couple of days. And here's another one. Stop overpaying for a great shave. You'll notice my mustache is gone. How did that happen? My Harry's razor. Harry's blades are super sharp. They provide a close, comfortable shave. You get two things with Harry's. Amazing quality, low prices. Actually, three things. Because they deliver it to your house. And it's quality guaranteed. You get a full refund if you're not happy. We've gotten a lot of feedback on this and never heard from anybody that they weren't happy. Factory direct prices. They ship it right to your door. 5-blade cartridges. They sell their blades basically at the half price of leading blades. Apparently over 1 million guys have made the switch. I gotta say, the Harry's people are nice. They sent I don't know if you saw this, they sent a holiday card. Because I think a lot of Majority Report listeners have tried Harry's out. Or it's maybe just, they're just nice. I don't know.
Both.
Could be both.
It's just such a no-brainer.
You know what? Nobody's ever sent me. Like, I've never had any. I don't think I've gotten a business card from anybody, like, I do business with at all. I know. Well, I don't celebrate Christmas. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades when you can get them for half the price at Harrys.com? Their starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, 3 razor blades. And because it's $15, they generally don't provide any discounts. However, like I say, they're sending me cards now. Harry's will give you $5 off your first order with the promo code Majority Report. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Start the new year's off right. Go to harrys.com right now. That's HARRYS.com. Enter code Majority Report at checkout. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the Uber blogger, the proprietor of Hullabaloo, Digby. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Oh, folks, just a reminder, and we will probably have him on within the next week, but Professor Eddie Gloud, his book was released, I believe, either today or yesterday, Democracy in Black. We'll put a link on the Majority Report site. It's a fantastic book. I had read The Galleys, and we'll have him on to talk about it, but it really is a fascinating look, and I know that Eddie Gloud is one of the favorites on this program. And another one of the favorites on this program is, of course, our next guest. She is the proprietor of the Uber blog Hullabaloo. She is a contributing writer to Salon.com, Heather Digby Parton. Hello, Heather.
Hey, Sam.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. Still a little early out here on the West Coast, but I'm coffeeed up. I'm ready to go.
Well, I appreciate your getting up early for us, and it's been quite a week. I mean, I didn't even realize this. I think on Friday, but Monday night we had the forum. Last night we had the State of the Union. We have the Republican debate tomorrow night. We have then another Democratic debate on Sunday night. Which, of course, is the night before Martin Luther King's holiday. And I think there's some playoff games, so that will be sufficiently buried. And you know, actually, I want to talk to you. I hadn't mentioned this beforehand, but I want to talk to you about the potential challenger to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, because Blue America is supporting that candidate. But before we get there, let's start with the State of the Union, and then maybe we'll work backwards in time in terms of the Democratic Forum. I don't know that there was sort of anything really particularly new that we saw in that Democratic Forum. There were some things that I thought there were missed opportunities, probably on both sides, but So give me your first hot take on the on the State of the Union. Was there anything that was sort of surprising to you about it?
You know, honestly not. I mean, I had sort of anticipated that it was going to be a bit of a wistful affair, I think, for a lot of Democrats. Looking back, you know, 7 years ago, there was such euphoria and optimism. And I think, you know, the great long slog of a two-term presidency in this environment, it was bound to sort of have a bittersweet quality to it, I think. And that's sort of how I felt about it. I didn't really feel like he said anything. I mean, he has a right to take credit for everything that, you know, good that has happened in his two terms, and I think that's fair enough. Any president would and does, and I think he's probably correct in saying that he managed to navigate the country through a very, very challenging economic time, and, you know, we seem to have survived it, if not completely recovered. But, you know, it was probably, as far as I could tell, received by Democrats with the biggest kind of meh that right. any speech he's ever given did. But I think that was kind of, that was a logical consequence of, you know, all this time. And just the battering that you feel at the end of any long presidency, which is just, you know, how much more of this do we have to go?
Well, it's funny because I think that, like, there's not the sort of the same sense that I had at the end of the Bush administration, where it was just like GW was like, I got to get hell out of here, you know, like literally like running for the door on some level. I mean, I think, you know, the executive actions he took. I guess now starting a year ago, have, I think, you know, sort of injected some vigor into his presidency. I mean, he's also sounded pretty relaxed, I thought. But, you know, what struck me, the first thing, and part of it was knowing that I was going to be talking to you today, was the thing that you and I have, I think, now for the past 5 or 6 years have been sort of returning to, which I now refer to the sort of the Dan Pfeiffer admission, mm-hmm. right? Which is, just to remind people, Pfeiffer was one of the president's closest advisors. And when he left the White House, he had his sort of traditional, you know, look back on your time there interview. And he said that the biggest mistake, regret, whatever it was that the Obama administration came in with this notion that they could work with the Republicans, and it took them too long to understand that they couldn't do that. And so when Obama last night, and which, of course, was, you know, one of the biggest criticisms I think that people like yourself and I had made of the president, was that was he this deluded? And by him, I mean the administration, this diluted, or was this sort of some type of tactical thing, or was it strategic? And again, he sort of returned to that last night. But it was funny because on one hand, he's saying that. On the other hand, if I was a conservative Republican, I'd be sitting there going, like, God, I hate this guy, because he's almost talking past them last night. He's sort of saying, like, you know, we all agree, we're all excited that gay people can get married today. And, you know, and they're all just sitting there just like, God damn it, we can't say anything about how horrific this is and how America's falling apart. And yet he still sort of returned to this notion of, like, you know, we need to work together. It was just so strange in some ways to me, where he's saying, like, we all want, we accept the notion that people should be able to vote without encumbrances. What? You're looking out on, like, the biggest sort of group of people who have attacked the ability for Americans to vote in the past 40 years.
Well, and I think there may have been a sense, even among Democrats, that sort of like, hey, have you noticed that these other guys really don't agree with you on this? I think they did. And in fact, as I perused all the right-wing sites in anticipation of writing my piece for Salon this morning, last night. I mean, their reaction was exactly what you say, which is, what is he talking about? You know, that's ridiculous. And they were even, you know, Nikki Haley, who did the rebuttal, she sort of did a similar thing where she said, you know, we have to take responsibility. We have to own it. Republicans have to own the fact that we're partially responsible for what happened, that we're not getting along. The right wing went crazy. And Ann Coulter even tweeted out, you know, Donald Trump should deport Nikki Haley. This was not received well among the right, this message of unity. They didn't want to hear it, and they don't want to hear it, and they don't believe it. I have to think, and it's funny because I had written the day before, on Monday, I wrote sort of a pre State of the Union piece for Salon, and in it I went back to that interview that you just referenced, the Dan Pfeiffer thing. And in that, he said that Obama's greatest regret was not being able to, you know, bring people together the way he had promised. That was his greatest unfulfilled promise. And, you know, I just have to say, I find that really fatuous. I mean, I like Obama in a million ways, and I'm really glad that he's taken on this YOLO lame duck thing. You know, you only lame duck once.
Right.
And he's doing all these things, and I find his second term much more satisfying than his first in any number of different ways. And I, you know, I don't mean to be critical of him, but that particular sentiment of his, and I think he actually believes it, and I think my personal feeling is that it comes from his own experience in life prior to coming to Washington, which was that he did have, he was a person who had transcended a lot of lines in his life and felt he had a special competence at doing that, and Washington frustrated him because he was unable to. But I think it's a fatuous idea, because there are ideologies at work here. They're real. People have them. They believe them. It's not just some, you know, sense that they need, you know, a leader to come along and stitch together this great American patchwork quilt and we'll all live happily ever after. That just isn't what's going on, and I found it a little frustrating to hear him go on about that last night myself. I mean, I'm on his side, but we're in a battle, and it's a pretty big one, and it's raging between both parties, and it's raging within both parties, and there are issues being fought out here. I mean, real world views, clashing of, you know, people always talk about the clash of civilizations. Well, this is a clash of American worldviews. And I just think it's people just have to accept that. It is what it is. I mean, I'm sorry we can't all just, you know, we can't all get along, but every once in a while you've got to air this stuff. Get out there and say it and be willing to stand up for what you believe and basically do it. And the funny thing is that Obama's been doing that in his second term. I mean,
sort of surprised me. There was sort of this duality. Like, on one hand, I mean, you know, first off, like, you know, again, just to, I guess in somewhat to reiterate what you're saying here is that, you know, we are still, you know, we are told by the sort of the political establishment. And I have an example of this in a minute, that, you know, it's really and there's a lot of voters out there who sort of say, like, why can't they just get along? And, you know, we all agree on what the problem is. Let's just hammer out and compromise on the solution. But the bottom line is, we don't all agree what the problem is. That is the fundamental unspoken truth, it seems, of our politics today, is that there is a fundamental disagreement about what the problems are. I mean, yep. You know, the right believes that the problem is that we're not articulating a machismo enough stance with certain things. I mean, you can see it even in this resolution of these 10 naval personnel coming back from Iran. This resolves nothing for a wide swath of the body politic in this country. It's not about getting those 10 guys back. It's about what did we come off looking like as we got them back? I mean, I think there's a lot. I honestly, genuinely believe that there are people who would have been more satisfied, even if these people came back in body bags, if we had approached the situation differently, more, I don't know, muscularly or something.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. You could see it yesterday with the reactions to this whole thing. There was a febrile excitement in the air that, you know, hey, let's get it on. Yeah, we're going to mix it up now. We need to mix it up. And then the opposite side of that, well, Obama's, you know, he's just way too much of a weakling to actually do what needs to be done here. And I do want to give a shout-out to the media this morning for showing on a loop the pictures of these sailors being detained originally with, you know, their hands up and, you know, being on their knees on the ship deck. So that all these people can be fed their sense of
right.
of American weakness and surrender in the face of, you know, the great Satan enemy of Iran. I mean, the truth of the matter is, and I think this is absolutely correct, yeah, they did stray into Iranian waters. That was admitted. This happens. And when you have a diplomatic channel like we now have with Iran, these things tend to not have to escalate the way that they did in the past. And you know, go through a process, and then they get returned. And Iran had a lot at stake in not escalating this process, and so they didn't. And it's actually a total validation of the idea that diplomacy and working hard at building those relationships, even with people who you might consider an enemy, is worth doing. That is anathema to the right wing. There is no such thing.
I mean, and that is the end.
Respect that in the least.
It's not a means to them. It is an end. I mean, we need to, our foreign policy needs to be about showing, showing a certain, visage of ourselves out there, that we need to create this sort of image. And it doesn't matter if we got them back. It's really more about are the Iranians afraid of us now? No. So there, that to me, the President Obama completely glossed over. At the same time, though, it was really funny to me, like where he's like, we can all get along. We're all excited that we finally achieved marriage equality, and people just like, that whole sort of, there was that moment there where it was just like hilarious to watch.
I know. Paul Ryan is sitting in the background, just stone faced, doesn't even crack a smile. He's barely blinking. He was turned to stone behind him in that whole litany of things that we're all so proud of. And, it is, I just think it's kind of absurd to continue this notion. This is what Obama built his entire reputation on, and there were his whole persona was based upon the idea that his first speech when in the 2004
right.
Democratic convention, where he said, we worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we whatever the thing is, there is no red and blue. And it was a very compelling speech. You go, isn't that great? And when you're on the other side of it, you're in the minority, as we were in 2004, that sounds really good, because it sounds like maybe you're going to get something out of it, right?
Right. Well, that's what I was just thinking. I seem to remember everybody saying, we did not at that time take that as a call for, as a kumbaya moment. We took that as a rebuke against the Bush administration.
Yes. Yes,
which was
exactly,
was,
and I think that's what it was, or at least I thought it was at the time. I mean, looking back, perhaps it seems as though Obama has built his political career around that idea,
right?
And that he carried it on. Now, just to go back a little bit, you and I are, we remembering the Pfeiffer interview and looking back at the first few years in which Obama. There is nobody, and I don't care what anybody says, who can say that he did not try. And he did try. He went so far as to put Social Security on the table.
Yeah.
In budget deals. I mean, his grand bargain was all about trying, and he was very serious about it. This was not a tactic on his part. He truly believed that he would be able to solve these huge problems that have been out there, these big arguments, by virtue of his persuasive powers alone, and that people would come together, they would do these, quote, make the, quote, hard decisions, like, being in poverty in their old age, for the greater good. And then we would be able to move on to all these important things that are not being addressed because of the obstacles of these great big problems. Well, that was a ridiculous notion. But I think he actually believed it. I actually do think he believed it. And it had to be proved to him in a brutal fashion.
But even if he didn't actually believe, I mean, you know, if like I take the, you know, and at the end of the day, it may not matter. The you know, there's a more cynical view too, which I think, you know, sometimes I embrace, is that, you know, they have their bucket list of this is what's going to make our legacy. And if we get our version of welfare reform, we're going to be in great shape.
Oh, I think that was part of it too.
And sure. And you know, I mean, the irony is, and this is what sort of scares me a little bit about you know, the prospect of Hillary Clinton, is that you know, she's making the case the other day in Iowa that she's going to be able to bring people together more, and I'm like worried. Oh. Like for me, the best thing I can say about those years is that thank God he was not successful at that. I mean, you know, it was so weird last night when he's saying, like, we all agree we need to protect Social Security, you know, and make it stronger. And you know, Joe Biden steps up and I'm just like looking, going like, hey, guys, you're the ones who put cutting that on the table.
No kidding. Especially Biden. I mean, he
yes.
was basically, you know, he was in there making the deals behind Harry Reid.
Yeah,
back.
He undercut Harry Reid on that big big debt ceiling or the big fiscal cliff deal.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, like, you got to be kidding me. And I'm glad you guys failed, you know, mission not yes. accomplished. And thank goodness. And I'm worried about someone who could competently come in there and reach across the aisle. And then I sort of snap back to reality and I go, these guys are lunatics. We're still 15, 20 years out before there's yeah. going to be a, you know, a partner for peace across the aisle. And
well,
thank goodness.
Well, just look at what's happened with immigration reform. I mean, that tells you everything you need to know
right.
about the likelihood of that. I mean, that is what I called the other day in a piece I wrote. It's the political equivalent of climate change for the Republicans. If they don't deal with this immigration issue, they will not win national elections. They know it. They know they have crunched the numbers backwards and forwards, and they understand that they have a problem. They can't do anything about it. They are stuck in this, you know, rut with their base, which is just, you know, which is hostile to immigrants, to anyone, you know, any foreigner, any person of color. I mean, that's just part of their oeuvre. And if you look at the presidential candidates, I mean, look what has happened. I mean, Marco Rubio.
Right. Oh, exactly.
Was. No. I mean, it's obvious what's going on. So to me, that tells you everything you know about the environment. I don't care what Nikki Haley said last night. I'm sure that the RNC wanted her to come out and give a, you know, put a decent face on the Republican Party for people who might have stuck, you know, around long enough to see her and hear what she was saying. But it cannot transcend what's going on in this presidential race and what's going on in the Congress. They can't do anything about it. And frankly, I mean, ask yourself, if the president were Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, either one, does anyone think that there's a chance that either of those two people could make headway with the Republican Party?
I certainly hope not. I mean, honestly, yeah. I hope not. And you know, here's the thing, is that do you think that we are close? I mean, this will help me segue into this. There was a piece by Chris Saliza, God help me, about the State of the Union speech in the Washington Post. And you hear this quite a bit, like, you know, that President Obama was talking to, you know, was trying to chastise Donald Trump during this speech. And this is what Saliza writes. Yet the specter of Trump was everywhere in Obama's speech. Quote, we need to reject any politics that targets people because of our race or of race or religion, he said. Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction, he said. The world will look to us to solve problems. Our answers need to be more than tough talks or calls to carpet bomb civilians. Well, the fact is that in those three quotes that Saliza says is a direct rebuke to Trump, he's picked out basically four or five Republicans who have said literally these things, like carpet bombs. Exactly. That's Ted Cruz. Tough talk. I mean, Lindsey Graham's entire campaign was a function of that. The idea that the economy is in decline. There's three or four of those things. Because of our race or religion, Jeb Bush wanted to do a Christianity test. And so I guess my point is that, like, are we at, aside from the fact that the mainstream media still refuses to recognize that the story is about the Republican Party and not Donald Trump, it's the people who support Donald Trump, not that Donald Trump is some type of magical wizard who's able to sort of conjure up something that wasn't there before. But are we close to that point where even the construction, even the way that, like, that we say, the Republican Party knows it has a problem with immigration, but they can't do anything about it. I mean, are we almost at the point where that's flipped? In the same way that, like we would not say, you know, that it's really like there is a small faction of the Republican Party that believes that if they have a future, it's got to be about immigration. But the Republican Party now doesn't know that. It doesn't know. I mean, if you know, to the extent
I don't think the voters know.
That's what I mean.
Republican voters don't seem to know. In fact, I wrote this the other day. I was sort of breaking down all the factions in the party. I think I was talking about Ted Cruz and how he's very systematically gone about trying to appeal to all the various factions within the party, which one wouldn't have thought that he'd be able to do, since he's, you know, very clearly associated with the far right. But he has been able to do it. And in the end of it, I pointed out, there is a fringe. It's called the Republican establishment.
Right, right.
They are the fringe. And Cruz, that's the one group that Cruz feels that he doesn't really have to appeal to. That they are the group, in other words, that is going to have to
accept him.
Accept him, not the other way around. And I do think that may very well be what's happening, that the party itself, the majority, that when you put together their faction, their various factions, which are, you know, I mean, the evangelical right, the nationalist, the racist, the, you know, the whole group, the fiscal conservatives, all of them, I think that the establishment, which you would, you know, let's just say that they're the pragmatic political professionals who realize you have to get elected in order to enact an agenda. That is a fringe now. That is a small faction within the party, very small. And the rest, I just don't think that there are. Who are these moderates? Who are they voting for? Who are they polling?
How
many of them are there?
It's also not just a question of ideology. I mean, there was a story the other day that the Koch brothers network now hires 3.5 times the amount of people that the RNC
yes.
does. The amount of money that's in there. So even the sort of like put aside the ideology. Just look at it in terms of like, you know, sort of like corporate loyalty. You know, you're just not, there's no advancement for you in the way that there was 15 years ago, 10 years ago, to work your way through the Republican Party apparatus. It's like, I can do just as well in, the alt Republican world. I can do better.
Better, by far. I mean, that's where the money is, right? And, you know, Republicans are always pretty good at sussing that out. And it is true. I mean, you had Charles Koch giving an interview to the, I think it was the New York Times or was it the Wall Street Journal, just a couple of days ago, saying that he was disappointed so far that he hadn't had enough, that, you know, the rich people hadn't had quite the influence they felt they deserved. Mm. But the truth is that's establishment. Yeah, it is BS. But it's it's the kind of thing that an establishment Republican would say, right? I mean, it's like he's the guy who's trying to be practical and put together a real, electoral, institutional, you know, kind of
right.
Program. And it's very tough, you know, herding cats and all that stuff, you know, the stuff that they say. But that's him. That's Koch saying that.
So right. He's like not talking like an insurrectionist. He's talking about the problems it has to maintain this institution I've built. Called the new Republican
Party. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and there's no doubt that they're doing that, Sam. I mean, we've all read about what they basically have the, you know, as the Democrats have this voter database that would, you know, the big scandal between Clinton and Sanders. The Republican database does not exist in the Republican Party. It is part of the, I mean, it's pretty much been outsourced.
Yeah.
The Koch people, their institution, Americans for Prosperity and various other groups like that, they're the ones who are maintaining the database. Very, very interesting. And I think, you know, what does that mean for the future? Is this a party? is the Republican Party an actual political party?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's fascinating to see that. There was a piece in the Times today about how the establishment reluctantly now is starting to warm to Cruz. But that was his last stop, right? I mean, he just basically, you know, got to their house and said, "Hey, look at it. I got the whole neighborhood behind me. You want to join us or do you want to stay in your house?" I mean,
that's so interesting. I've got to look that up because I actually wrote that, you know, I was on the bubble on that one because I wrote that about Cruz a while back, which is that he is. I've been sort of predicting for a while, looking at what's going on. I don't have a crystal ball, but my feeling has been that really, the two men left standing are likely to be Trump and Cruz.
Yep.
And that Cruz was, in my view, the more likely choice that the Republican establishment, who hates him with every fiber of their being. But that they would reluctantly accept him as the vehicle to stop Trump.
Well, the irony is it's because you can actually make a deal with
exactly.
Cruz.
That's exactly right. Trump is an actual political animal. He's not this thing, this sort of amorphous celebrity politico, you know, cartoon character that Trump is, who is uncontrollable.
Right.
Cruz may be somewhat uncontrollable, but he still works within the parameters of a political system that we recognize. You know, Trump is operating way outside that. And I think that in the end, I read a piece by Rich Lowry in Politico about 2 weeks ago, in which he hates Ted Cruz with every fiber. But he was sort of saying, you know, I have to admit, looking at him, he's been run a very smart campaign, and he's been very organized, and he works harder than anybody. And I'm going, okay, they're starting to work it through. It's not, they don't want to, they don't like it, but somewhere in their heads, they're going, this is the only guy who can stop Trump, and we have to stop Trump.
The irony
that's my feeling.
The irony is that we just heard from, there was just a piece out about that Paul Ryan, in a meeting, a Republican pollster went in there and said that Ted Cruz was going to be the most damaging to House prospects for the Republicans. I'm not sure how much I believe that. I mean, you know, every time you hear something like that, like, Paul Ryan got this top secret information, and here it is for you, broad public. I always get a little bit suspicious about what I'm hearing, but I think that is, you know, that to me just sounds more like a negotiation, right? Where it's just like, look, Ted, to bring along, you know, X, Y, and Z, we need you to do this and that. And I think he's going to negotiate with them. It's just that he's doing it with a lot more leverage, I think, than one would have anticipated. All right, there was one other thing that just stuck out for me, and if we get maybe a minute or two, we got a couple of minutes to talk about. I want to just do one last thing on the State of the Union that is sort of a little bit of a non sequitur, but this really struck me. It was, you know, and Obama definitely has this quality about him where he did this quite a bit during the campaign. And in some instances, I find it really sort of, I find it very problematic, where he gets in front of an audience and then he chastises them. And you know, you hear the right saying, like, you know, how dare he lecture us about getting along with whatnot. He's done that. Like, he went to Wall Street, if you recall, in the 2008 election and got in front of them and said, you guys, you're not doing, you know, proper things and this and that. I mean, was not terribly effective, and this was prior to the crash. But he has this habit, and what I was really struck by this line where he said, and I wonder if there's ever been a president who's ever said that, particularly in this setting, that we spend more on our military than the next nations combined. I was really struck by this. Let's play this clip.
I told you earlier, all the talk of America's economic decline is political hot air. Well, so is all the rhetoric you hear about our enemies getting stronger and America getting weaker. Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth. Period. Period. It's not even close. It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world.
That to me was such a fascinating couple of sentences, because first he says, you know, the idea that our enemies are getting stronger and we're getting weaker is bunk. And you hear this like, whoa, oh my gosh, oh, how could he say something like that? Like, our enemies are supposed to be really strong. How else can we work on the American citizens into a froth? And then he says, we're the most powerful nation on earth. And this huge applause of like, yes, American exceptionalism. And then he pulls the rug out of everybody by saying, because, of course, we spend so much money to be that. Like, there was a sense, the combined houses thought, like, yes, we're so morally righteous that we are the most, we transcend Earth. We're like, it's Earth, us, and then God is really just about up there, and that's about it. But then he just basically says, oh, yeah, we're there because we spend a lot of money. Yeah, we're not floating. We just built a really big tower. And that's why we're so much closer to God. And then, of course, he pulls it back with the troops are the greatest in the history of the world. And people can then applaud again as if it's a function of not that we spend so much money. I found that just fascinating. The responses and, you know, just him being that frank, and I'm not even sure he understood how people react to it in that room.
Well, yeah, everything in that regard is kind of upside down. The Frank Luntz runs these, you know, sort of bogus dial-up focus groups when these things happen, and he tweeted out when Obama said that all the Republicans in his dial-up group laughed out loud when he said that America was the most powerful nation on earth. And, you know, I actually retweeted it going, you know, why do they hate America so much? And then I went and looked. I went over to Megyn Kelly's Facebook page, and the reaction among her followers was just absolute, total anger. Here's one, what he said, has he been in another world for the last 7 years? America has declined every day under his failed, weak, ideological, disjointed, illogical, politically motivated attempt at leadership. They were absolutely angry. Now picture us sitting here having this conversation, nine, 10 years ago. I mean, if you and I had ever uttered the slightest criticism of America as a nation, we were, you know, basically batted down as treasonous, America haters, mm-hmm. who hated the troops, and, you know, we're the blame America first crowd, and how dare you say that we are the greatest country the world has ever known, these colors don't run, love it or leave it, you know. That was the reaction. Now, these people are all saying this, and interestingly, on the opposite side, you have, you know, euphoric Democrats standing up and cheering and crying, yes, we are the most powerful nation on earth, and kind of in a more sickening example, applauding furiously at him talking about how he took out terrorist leaders in Yemen and Osama, you know, and mm-hmm. patting himself on the back for Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, Osama bin Laden if I'm weak or something to that effect.
Yeah, tell me, you know, he's not afraid of, you know, he's not around anymore to be afraid. Yeah, the whole thing was just that whole section of the speech to me was just very, very strange. And I found the reaction on the right particularly interesting. And, of course, that's reflected in the Trump campaign more than any others. That is the campaign that is reflecting this idea of America being this big, fat loser of a country. His book, his campaign book is called Crippled America. I mean, can you imagine Ronald Reagan? you know, writing a book called Crippled America. I mean, that was just, it was unheard of. I mean, you might have, I mean, remember what they said about Jimmy Carter's malaise speech? I mean, he basically just sort of said, you know, we really probably should buck up a little bit, and everybody went crazy. So it's a very weird dynamic.
Yeah.
And, you know, very strange kind of, you know, obviously, I mean, to me, Obama sounded defensive there, you know, like he, I mean, that's how I took it, and perhaps I'm an outlier on that, but it was like, you know, he was defending his macho bona fides in that whole thing, and basically trying to sort of convey the fact that, you know, of course we're strong. And he's right. I mean, we are. We do spend more than anybody, and it is because we spend more than anybody. And by the way, you know, on the backs of the American
taxpayer. Well, of course.
There,
and,
you know,
and,
I
yeah,
mean,
and,
we're paying for it.
And, you know, I just, the reaction from the combined Senate and the House, where it was like, you know, don't tell us we're on steroids. Just tell us how fast we can run the 50. Like, you know, we don't want to know why. We just want to assume it's because of our raw talent and strength that God gave
us.
This
exceptional,
superior, yes.
Our exceptionalism. We are that special, that we are the most powerful nation on earth simply because we're us. You know, because we are who we are. We're so terrific. Let's pat ourselves on the back. I mean, that's Trump right there, right?
Yeah, I found
we're going
to
have so many victories, they'll be coming out of your ears. And yes. He says, you know, he says, and this is his promise, which I find really, really clever because it's just so ridiculous considering who it's coming from and the party he's running in. We're going to have a military so strong that no one will ever mess with us. The idea being, we don't have to fight wars because no everyone will be afraid of us. Well, I mean, that's actually the reality already. I mean, who is attacking America on any militaries? I mean, anybody sending their fleet over to
right.
to invade? I mean, that's not happening, and nobody is provoking the United States. I mean, we went through the whole Cold War with a you know, as it turned out when we looked back on it, we were far, far superior on any military level, even though we pretended like we weren't through the whole thing. This is not something that is on any factual basis reality, that America, that Donald Trump needs, that anybody needs to come in and boost our military to the point where no one will mess with us. Nobody's going to mess with us. We have the world's most
well, to the extent that anybody messes with us, it's not going to be like we're going to be, you know, they're starting to amass tanks on the Mexican border. I mean, that's just not, there is no, yes, I mean, it's a silliness, but that to me just gets back to the whole sort of, you know, the Republican thing is really less about sort of the mechanics. It's really, that's the ends. It's not even the means, because the means is, we want to get this big so that nobody messes with it. No, we just want to get this big so that we can look in the mirror and literally
yeah.
sort of fawn
that's
over
it,
ourselves
it.
In some weird
that's
way.
That's it. That's it. They want to feel good about themselves, and they want, you know, they're for whatever reason feeling that instead of their own sense of failure or I don't know despair or somehow you know lack of success in life. Is being sort of extended to the United States as a country, and that the country itself is a reflection of their own feelings of dissatisfaction. And I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I noticed the other day there was some polling out which showed that most people are feeling much more satisfied in their personal lives than they were, say, 5 years ago. Obvious reasons, right? The economy was in the tank, and now it's improving, and people are feeling much more satisfied. And, in fact, it's reaching levels that are higher than it's been in many, many, many years. And maybe that's just the contrast between things being better and people are feeling a sense of relief. That's in their personal lives. On the idea that, you know, the country is doing better, it is absolutely sinking to record lows.
Mm.
That the idea that America is doing better. And, you know, I can't explain it. I mean, you would, you know, obviously there's something. Maybe it's just an effect of this ideological battle we're talking
well,
about.
Well, I think there's a sort of a broad consensus. I mean, not necessarily in the same thing, but there is something systemic that is problematic. That's the sense that I get, is that, you know, there's, and on one hand, it's, you know, look, I can understand the idea of I'm going to project my sense of despair onto the country on some level, right? I mean, you know, if the Patriots put aside everybody, the whole, you know, whatever, Deflategate, whatever it is. But if the Patriots win that day, I'm excited for a couple of hours. And, you know, there's no real reason why I should be. I have no investment in the Patriots.
You're not in terms of money, like,
I'm not a football player. I don't know anybody on the team, you know. And but it's just it's that,
sure.
you know, sort of like weird human frailty. But I'm also sort of like a. You know, I have the emotional maturity of at least a, you know, someone in their late teens. And so I can move past that and say, okay, this isn't really about me. And I think that's part of the problem is that, like, literally we have the vast majority of this country is sort of stuck in a sort of an emotionally arrested state in some way.
I think you're right. That makes perfect sense to me. That, I mean, and there is this, I mean, everything about this, in so many ways, has just, it reeks of adolescent angst and, you know, people trying to prove their manhood or womanhood or whatever it is, you know, and there's so much of that in our culture. That's probably a subject for somebody to study in depth. And
oh, I would imagine. I mean, I just, you know, remember there was this like a little Twitter war between these sort of teen conservative talkers. Right. I mean, these guys who, you know, anybody could do what I'm doing now, just set up a, you know, a camera or a microphone and talk into it. And apparently there's a network of teen conservative talkers, and one conservative talker like sort of left the fold. But I ended up like looking at what this like 12-year-old kid doing. I can't remember his name, but maybe Matt. Well, and who was
Caden Cowger?
Yes. Okay. And so he's doing a thing about how Obama is pushing homosexuality on everybody. This is like 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh my God.
And he's in a junior high, and he's going like, I know at least maybe 30 kids in my county who are gay, and they were not gay before. And this is, and it's just sort of like, what was shocking to me was like how similar it was to what like grown adults in the Republican Party say. And
oh,
I'm just
senators, thinking, remember Tom Coburn ran saying that there were school junior highs all over Oklahoma who were forcing little girls to be lesbians by making them, you know, I mean,
and it's just like this sort of like this sort of like, you know, that note, I was like, this is why they keep having a series of like teen sensations in the conservative movement, because there's really not fundamental, you know, there's polish and there's delivery and a certain experience, but the essence of what they're talking about completely resonates. It's completely arrested.
Oh, it does. And they're so impressed by it because they see these kids saying what the kind of thing that dumb kids say, because they're dumb kids, you know.
But you're talking like a 45-year-old.
Brilliant. Right, yes, right. My God, this guy is, he's a genius. You know?
He's a genius. He sounds just like me as a 45-year-old.
No, exactly.
They don't stop and think like, hey, wait a second, maybe the problem's with me.
My favorite is the one, you remember the kid who went to CPAC? I think his name was Jonathan Crone.
We interviewed him when he moved to New York and basically renounced his youth. And he's like, he did say, Crone himself said, like, I was always sort of amazed that they took me so seriously.
Right. He grew up and became, you know, like a normal person and read a book or two and experienced a little life and went, oh, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because he actually did have a brain.
It's
I know, it's hilarious.
Well,
it's hilarious.
Didn't get to the Democratic forum at all, and I guess we will have more time next week. There's on Sunday night. There's a debate. We didn't also talk about Debbie Wasserman Schultz, her challenger. But can people get more information on that challenger? I'm going to talk about it in a bit. But...
go to Blue America, you know, type in your Google, Blue America. The guy's name is Tim Canova, C-A-N-O-V-A, and he is he's a law professor and an expert on monetary policy, which should be a very interesting debate between him and Wasserman Schultz. You know, he's a really good progressive, and we're kind of excited about him doing this. You know, who knows what will happen, but if you want to hear it more about him, you can go to the Blue America page, and there's a lot of stuff about him online.
Yeah, and it would be so great to get Debbie Wasserman Schultz out. I mean, and what a great 2016 to have Steve Israel gone, and then Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
They need to clean house. Let's face it. And you know what? I mean, I'm hearing, and I'm sure you're hearing it too. Even villagers are saying, you know what? It's time to get rid of Debbie. I mean, she really has nobody defending her anymore. I mean, her management of the DNC has been pretty dismal, and her behavior and the way that she goes about recruiting candidates and working with candidates, all of it, there's a really bad history there, and I think people are just fed up.
Do you think, let me ask you about this, sort of like a more meta question about this whole sort of debate cycle. I feel like there was a huge missed opportunity. I don't care who anybody supports. It seems to me like I can understand in a vacuum thinking like, okay, strategically, we're going to bury these debates and that's going to help the candidate that's in the lead. But I don't think it's working out that way at all is my sense. I mean, I think, everybody has their own sort of, preference in terms of this Democratic primary. But I don't think if I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, if I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter, even if I'm a Martin Amalio supporter, I don't think that any of them are being helped by this debate thing. And it's particularly going to hurt them, I think, in the general election, because there's not the opportunity to frame this narrative of look at the freak show and then look at these people who have, you know, the arguments that you should have in a primary.
I think it showed a tremendous lack of confidence. I really do. I think the idea, I mean, look, it's conventional wisdom that, you know, you don't want to expose yourself too much to, especially for a front runner. Like Clinton, to expose herself to, you know, any situation that might upset the apple cart. But that's ridiculous. I mean, she's actually pretty good at it. Sanders is pretty good at it. These debates have been illuminating. And this cycle, they made a very, very big miscalculation. You know, free media in this cycle has been hugely important. And, you know, on the Republican side, those debates have exposed all kinds of interesting things to the public, some not so good, some good. I agree with you. The Democrats missed a tremendous opportunity to be out there showing themselves to be the, you know, for lack of a better word, the grown-ups in this whole thing. And the adults and the statesmen and women, I honestly do not understand why they didn't at least try once they saw this dynamic coming down.
Right, that's this. I can understand the first impetus. The Republicans were going to get conservative with their debate schedule. Let's get conservative with ours. Let's see, everybody's going to lay low. But at one point it became clear that, like, wait a second, this is a very different situation than we thought it was going to be.
From the minute that the first Republican debate got 26 million viewers, I think everybody, their antenna should have gone up, and they should have realized, oh, this is different. We've got a lot of people who are interested. And it's not just Trump. I mean, they got the first Democratic debate got 15 million, which was far, far more than anybody ever. Even the biggest Obama-Clinton debates back in 2008 only got half of that. So they made a very big error. I don't know where it comes from. I think a lot of people think it was the Clinton camp. Maybe it was Wasserman Schultz. Maybe it was some combination.
It's hard for me to believe that it's not a combination. I mean,
the Sanders people didn't fight it either in the beginning. Apparently, they agreed to the schedule, and, you know, there hasn't been a huge demand until very recently for more. that, you know, it's just a mistake to run from that in this cycle, because this kind of, this exposure is super valuable. People are interested, and they should have picked that up. And I think it's really unfair. The good news is, and I don't know whether or not this will hold up, but somebody said the other day that the debate on Sunday actually comes after the playoff game. So maybe there'll be a lead-in.
Maybe there'll be a lead-in.
You know, and they'll get a bigger audience. I don't know if that's true. I just saw it on, you know. I saw it on Twitter, so it must be true.
Well, I hope so, and frankly, I'd like to see, you know, as someone who wants to see at the very least Sanders leverage what he's got going. I mean, even aside from the race, I'd like to see like more markers laid down. That's one of the big things. Like, you know, as he was talking about the TPP and the last debate. I'm just wondering myself, like, you know, why isn't Sanders saying, I will take a pledge that if I become president, I will not sign the TPP under any circumstances? That's the type of thing that, like, we should be seeing in these things, because then, you know, then Clinton has to do this. I mean, he could actually sort of start to leverage some of this stuff a little bit.
Exactly.
I don't know.
And she could do the same thing on guns, for instance. You
exactly.
Know, I mean, this is the whole point of primaries. You know, it was a missed opportunity in 2008 that we didn't, that the progressives were unable or unwilling to leverage Clinton and Obama, because they were both coming from pretty much the same place. But you could have, they were searching for differences, and you could have done that. I think, you know, the lesson here is that each of these candidates should be pushing. I mean, I say that the lesson as from the perspective of a progressive,
right?
you know, they can be doing this, but I would hope that is the end result, is that we'll see an agenda that is substantially further to the left, regardless of who gets in, than it would have been otherwise as a result of this whole thing, which is great.
No. Indeed.
I couldn't be happier.
Digby, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Sam. And, you know, exciting week ahead. Republican debate, Democratic debate. Oh, golly.
Here we go. And, who knows? Maybe they'll actually nominate a guy who's not eligible to be president.
Wouldn't that be great? I'd love it.
That would be so funny. Digby, thank you so much. Always
thanks,
so much
Sam.
Fun.
Talk to you later. Bye.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. A reminder, this program exists because of your largesse. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you an extra 50 minutes of, usually like an hour, of the program in the fun half. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Or if you want to do nothing other than just do your shopping, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard me say that if you buy your things from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Well, now you have another option to shop, do nothing, and get us a kickback. That is through jet.com. If you go to majorityreportkickback.com, you will see also our jet.com link. And your first purchase at Jet, 15% off, I think it is. So check it out. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. Tomorrow night, we will be covering the Republican debate live. See you in the fun app.